very deadpan. You know, we're getting towards the end, but I am really thrilled that before the end, we were able to get on someone who I've met in person, but someone who I think, you know, is really one of our important people in the science fiction and speculative fiction field today. And I think, you know, if he'd been out in the time of Asimov and those guys, then he would have been mentioned in the same breath as the Heinleins and Asimovs. He's just a great idea man and a great, I guess he's within science fiction and something you'd call a renaissance man. But I want to thank you very much, David Lee Summers, for coming on, taking the time out of your extremely busy schedule, coming on to talk to all of us at Deadpan.
Well, thanks for having me, Jack. It's a real honor for me to be here.
No, it's an honor for me to have you here. So I don't really know where to begin with all the amazing things that you do. You have an amazing day job. You know, you have an amazing job by night. You know, I'm sure that somewhere in there you're a crime fighter as well, but,
I can't think of any crimes that I've solved, but I've bested a few ghosts here and there. I have a graduate advisor who claims to have been responsible for the Roswell UFO. A lot of fun things that way, but I work up at Kitt Peak National Observatory. It's really one of the great jobs. I operate the 4-meter and Wind 3.5 meter telescopes up there, support a lot of the visiting astronomers that come through, some of the staff astronomers that come through. Really kind of feel like I kind of have my hands in some of the cutting edge of science today, which is a lot of fun.
That, you know, that's fantastic stuff. And you know, I know that's one of the most powerful, and that's one of the most powerful research facilities in the world for space studies.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we're even today we're you know, 50 years into the observatory's existence, we're still supporting the Kepler space probe, following up on potential planet discoveries, determining which stars are really binary stars, which ones are really planets. We have a brand new instrument just now coming online called the 1-degree imager, which gets one of the largest swaths of sky at really high resolution than just about any telescope out there. You know, it's really just going through commissioning now, but I have high hopes for what that instrument's going to do. We have other new spectrographs getting ready to come online. I think Kitt Peak's days are, you know, I think in a way we're, you know, we're 50 years old and far from over. I think we have a lot of science to contribute.
Well, great. And so, and in addition to the cool toys that you just mentioned, what cool things are, or what exciting things are you watching and studying? I mean, you mentioned a few things, but is there anything out there that you feel is really, kind of exciting, and kind of what are you eager to kind of get back to work and get back to studying?
Well, as far as you know, what I do is pretty much I'm the on-site technical support guy in a lot of ways. You know, when these people come in, scientists from the different universities around the country come in to, they propose for time and they look for these things. I'm kind of the guy that's on site that helps them get that data. So, you know, pretty much every week is something new for me. The things that are really kind of exciting me as far as what I've, the projects I know about, like I say, there's the Kepler follow-ups, which are basically looking for planets around different stars. Of course, we're looking for, really excited about the possibility of finding Earth-like planets in habitable zones. But even then, you know, some of the ones that are not habitable are pretty exciting as far as I'm concerned. There's, so far they found some, Jupiter-sized planets, going around stars with orbits of only like 2 days. And when you think about Mercury has an orbit of 88 days, you know, this is, that thing's, you know, planets like that are just really whipping around their stars. It's really nothing like we imagined, even as far back, you know, just when I was going to college in the 80s. You know, other things are just the search for dark energy is one of the big things, trying to understand why it is that the universe is accelerating. And we have some survey work getting set to get started that's going to just look into this and try to figure out why the universe is actually accelerating as it gets older. It's not slowing down or staying the same speed as you'd expect. There's just lots of really interesting things. Another survey is people are looking at some of these what they call low surface brightness galaxies, which some people theorize might be entire galaxies made of non-baryonic dark matter. So that's just very exotic kinds of things that are out there in the universe, and we're right there looking for them.
Jack Mangan's deadpan. But the coolest thing to hit your computer since you spilled that cold soda last week.
That's fantastic. And you know, of course, you get 1,000 points, or you get 5 life tokens, I guess, for landing a job like that. That's a passion of yours. Was this something when you were, I'm going to just a slight plug for us here. We did have Neil deGrasse Tyson on. We've actually had him on twice on Deadpan. Oh, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's only,
yes.
but he had mentioned that when he was 6, that he knew, I think his parents took him to the Museum of Natural History, and he said, oh, yep, this is what I'm going to do when I grow up. Was it like that for you, or is this something that, that you kind of grew into?
Pretty close to that kind of thing. I think for me, the experience was watching Carl Sagan's Cosmos, and seeing what he did on that show and looking at, the episode that really stands out in my mind is one called Blues for a Red Planet, where they were talking about Mars and at that time the Viking probes, which had just landed on Mars. And, that was the one that made me think, wouldn't it be really cool to be somehow involved in space exploration of some kind? And, that's the direction I went and got a degree in physics, and in the middle of grad school, I basically decided I was a little more interested in some of the engineering direction and some of the more technical support side, and I ended up leaving grad school and going to work for Kitt Peak National Observatory. So, I don't have the PhD behind my name, but I still get to do some of the fun exploration.
All right. Yeah, well, that's very cool. And obviously that takes up all of your time. I mean, you wouldn't possibly have any time beyond that, to be a father and a husband and an editor and an author, I'd assume. I mean, that must take up all of your time.
You would sure think so. It feels like sometimes, but yeah, it's the thing about it is the way the job works at Kitt, because I basically work 1 week and I have a whole week off. The way that works is my weeks on are, in the middle of winter, I'm working sunset to sunrise, so it can be up to 16 hours a night sometimes. That I'm working, so I'll work 6 nights at 16 hours and then come home and have 7, 8, maybe even 9 nights off at a stretch. And it's in that time that I come home, spend time with the family, and when the kids are at school, I write like crazy.
All right, and we're going to take a short pause here, but I think when we come back, then we'll get more into all of that. We have David Lee Summers here on The Deadpan. And
who is this irresistible creature who has an insatiable love for the dead?
Pan.
Okay, and we're back. Thanks for sticking with us and listening to our the ads from our sponsors. Of course, we don't have sponsors. This is a podcast, and this isn't Oprah. This is Deadpan. So we're talking to David Lee Summers, and David Lee Summers, we just talked a little bit about your day job. By day you're a mild-mannered astronomy technician. I don't know if that's your correct job title, but
right. It's the name is observing assistant. I've gone by all different kinds of titles over the years, from observing technician to assistant to research assistant to who knows what else. But observing technician works just fine.
Okay, and so now, let's jump right into it, because I'd be remiss to not give you the opportunity to plug your brand new novel. So, you know, I definitely want to talk about your publishing and your oeuvre. But let's talk about the new one that's out this month, October 2012. Let's talk about what you're pimping right now.
Well, the brand new book is Dragon's Fall: Rise of the Scarlet Order, which is a vampire book about a group of vampires who come together and become mercenaries, use the powers of their vampire powers, their strength, their ability to influence minds as a way to serve princes and governments and find food for themselves, so to speak. It's a prequel to my novel from 2004, Vampires of the Scarlet Order. And Dragon's Fall starts in Hellenistic Greece and moves through to the 1400s. And we see the individual vampires, basically three of the vampires, and their lives and how they intertwine and how they come together. And become a coherent team over this time. The novel's coming out on October 20th in ebook form, paperback to follow. And the best way for people to learn a little bit more about it and find out where to order it is to go to my website, davidleesummers.com, and click on the books and audiobooks link. And there's links right to all the places you can order it. We have just a couple up right now for the pre-orders, but should be coming soon to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places.
Okay, excellent. Now, will you have – it sounds like you will not have the hard copies with you then at TusCon, or will you?
Actually, I don't know yet. We're just waiting to find out when they're going to get the formatted copy back and get it to the printer and get it going. I think I think the hope is it'll be out in November, but I don't know whether we'll actually have the hard copies in time for TusCon or not.
Well, hopefully. And just there's a plug. You know, you can meet David and buy some of his books and get them signed and hopefully get the new one at TusCon, which is November 11th.
Yes, right? It's November 9, 10, and 11. And also to make another plug for TusCon, I'm fan guest of honor at TusCon, so I will be around all weekend. Looking forward to seeing anyone who's there.
That's right. I knew that. Yes. Congratulations. And, you know, we joked about that the last time I saw you. I said, you know, with all these other things you do, you know, you should be guest of honor for one of these other things. But, you know, I understand that you're a super fan as well. So, you know, it still is an honor. I mean, that's in no way a slight. And it's still a fantastic thing. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. And you know, the thing I tell people is, you know, even if you're going to be a professional writer, you know, never give up being a fan, because the minute you give up being a fan of this stuff, you know, all of this just becomes work, you know. You know, stick with it, enjoy it, you know, enjoy the people who are in this business. There's a whole bunch of great people, a whole bunch of great dreamers in this business. And, you know, how can you not be a fan of you know, cool people, ranging everywhere, like you say, from scientists like Neil deGrasse Tyson to Steve Sterling, who is the guest of honor at the convention. And there's all kinds of great people who come to TusCon from Weston Oates and Yvonne Navarro. Jenny Lee Simner will be there.
She's fantastic. She is
wonderful. So definitely come on down to Tucson and say hi to all of us. And everyone who is at TusCon is really great and open and definitely worth sitting down and chatting with.
Although I will, you know, let's not spend too much time on this, but there actually is a bit of a conflict for you, right? Because that's the same weekend that Dr. Phil Plait is doing an astronomy event in Tucson, right?
Yes.
So we won't give them too much press, you know. But
yes. Well, that's sort of the nature of business. So you end up, in fact, this last weekend I was down for a signing in Douglas, Arizona, and it was the same weekend as the Southwest Writers meeting in Tucson. And, you know, you kind of end up, you can't be in two places at one time, unfortunately.
Right.
Hello, this is Amy Bowen. You're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast. Deadpan is the way.
So, you know, let's get back to, now I'd say that your professional career is as diverse as your writing style. I mean, you've really been everywhere. In fact, you and I have sat together on steampunk panels, but yet, you know, your new novel is a vampire novel. And I know you've done what some would call hard science fiction. And I just remember, again, over the years sitting on panels with you and, you know, these concepts that you would toss out just offhand, like, yeah, I once wrote this book about this incredible idea that's blowing all of your minds right now. So let's talk, you know, you've written across many, many genres. Let's touch a little bit on that, too.
Well, the novels, pretty much, my first novels were pretty much space opera, you know, Star Trek type, Star Wars, you know, shoot 'em up, have fun, shooting across the galaxy kind of novels. And, you know, I love those. They're a great deal of fun. I've recently written a prequel to that whole series called The Solar Sea, which is a voyage across the solar system. More recently, I think a lot of my work and energy has been kind of going into steampunk. I really kind of like the historical fiction, taking and asking the what ifs and looking at the roads that traveled in history and seeing, you know, what might have happened if technology had just been taken a little further, or in a lot of ways going back and looking at some of these historical inventions that were done that sort of might have been invented but no one really pursued and built further. You know, and seeing where it all goes. I just kind of have a lot of fun with a lot of the steampunk stuff. And I think part of that actually ties a lot into my astronomy. And really all of my writing kind of ultimately comes back to that in some ways. You know, we talked about the vampire works. I actually started writing vampires because I was up at Peak. One of my fellow operators was a big fan of vampire fiction. She got me reading Anne Rice, got me reading Bram Stoker, got me reading all of that sort of thing. And I started thinking, you know, gee, how do, you know, Anne Rice had the you know, Lestat, who is the vampire rock singer. You know, what if you had a vampire telescope operator? And we, in fact, used to joke about, you know, vampire, you know, we were the vampires of the mountain because you would never see us before sunset and after sunrise. So, you know, I thought, you know, what if you actually wrote about that? And that became kind of the genesis of getting the ball rolling for Vampires of the Scarlet Order. One of the ideas for my second space opera novel, Children of the Old Stars, came out because one night at Kitt Peak Observatory, we were taking these infrared images of the center of the galaxy, and they were some of the deepest, highest resolution images that had ever been made of the center of the galaxy. And I thought, you know, gee, couldn't I tell a story where I visualize this somehow? And that became the genesis of Children of the Old Stars. You know, the steampunk kind of got started because back in the 80s, I was an assistant, had a summer job out at Mariah Mitchell Observatory in Nantucket. Mariah Mitchell was America's first woman astronomer, and she discovered a comet in the 1800s and became not only Vassar's first woman professor, but Vassar's first astronomy professor. And she left behind this legacy of training young people from small colleges in astronomy. And they had this great old Alvin Clark telescope. And Alvin Clark was really the master telescope maker of the 19th century. He built not just the world's largest telescope, but the world's next largest and the next largest after that. And he just left telescopes behind all around the world. Percival Lowell used an Alvin Clark telescope when he was looking for canals on Mars. And my first published paper on astronomy was on one of these Alvin Clark telescopes. and you just literally, you know, hand wind up gears and clockworks to explore the heavens. You know, it's just the essence of what steampunk is. So, you know, it all kind of comes back to the astronomy in a lot of ways, even though it's a lot of different genres.
Well, and yeah, and that is absolutely, you're right. That is such fertile steampunk ground. Wow, that's fantastic. Because you're right. I mean, that is steampunk in true history.
And I was going to say, yeah, living in the Southwest, you're just sort of steeped in history. The other element of the steampunk is, you know, I have. You know, Pat Garrett's literally buried a quarter mile behind my back door here in Las Cruces, New Mexico. You know, how can you kind of not write about some of these characters when they're literally, in the dust around you?
It's true. This is entirely a different topic, a topic for another day. But it's true that the history out here in Southwest, it's a little bit younger, you know, because I grew up in the East Coast. And so that's, you know, that's where you're going up the street to someplace where George Washington slept, and you know where people landed 400 or 500 years ago, but mm-hmm. Yeah, out here you're right. It's there are these handful of really colorful characters, and you're right, and it's a lot more recent. It's in some ways the stories are a lot more vivid in some ways. So that's and of course it's also much closer to the steampunk era as well.
Yeah, what's in a bit? Listening and fashioning it, sorry. You're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan. Deadpan is the way.
So that's and that's kind of cool to get the backstory, to get, you know, where your inspirations were. I mean, that's the dreaded interview question is, hey, where do you get your ideas? But you know, thank you for answering it anyway. And so
always glad to oblige.
and so now, you know, that's another thing that's, I know a lot of people find very difficult, to kind of straddle the line between author and editor, yet you've done this really well. I mean, you've been an editor for a very long time. There was Hadrosaur Tales and, of course, Tales of the Talisman. There's interesting history there, but, I mean, what can you tell us about that experience of, just running these publications for years?
Well, it's, it all started back in, my wife was in grad school at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and the way Hadrosaur Tales, the first magazine we ran, got started was essentially what we were actually after at that time was we wanted to, she had the idea of let's come up with an audio small press. And this was back in the days when all audiobooks, you know, were cassette tapes. You know, there weren't MP3 files on computers. I'm not even sure if the format existed at that time. Wave format had, as far as I know, just about been released. And, of course, those are really large files. So, you know, no one was even thinking about transferring those around on a computer at that point. So we actually went through and did the exercise of recording my first novel, The Pirates of Sufiro, on cassette tape, and took this around to some conventions and tried to sell it, and didn't meet with a whole lot of success for one reason and another, mostly just because of the price you had to charge to duplicate these things and sell them on individual tapes, and the fact that we didn't really know the great artists that I've come to know over the years now. The artwork was pretty much, you know, stuff that we sort of hand cobbled together, you know, with my own limited art skills and such. But anyway, we had the idea that we were going to feature audiobooks by new and upcoming talent. And we thought, what better way to showcase this than through an anthology of their short stories? And this was how the first couple of issues of Hadrosaur Tales came together. We thought, okay, these are going to be authors that, you know, we might want to showcase their longer works. And eventually it just came off that the anthology, the magazine, as you were, just took off on it and got legs all by itself. So we just said, fine, Hadrosaur Tales is a magazine. And we started doing this. At first it was once a year, then it became twice a year, three times a year. And we ran and did this for just about 10 years. And we got to a point where we said, okay, everyone think, you know, that the reason it was called Hadrosaur Tales was, one is the meaning of Hadrosaur. Hadrosaur, is literally, means big lizard, like dinosaur means thunder lizard. And two, we had, a Hadrosaur, which was a type of dinosaur, was discovered in Tucson about the time the press was discovered. But the curse was that everyone saw Hadrosaur Tales and they thought it was this kid's magazine about dinosaurs. So we said, okay, no, we're a science fiction and fantasy magazine. We're going to come up with a name that says science fiction and fantasy. And that was when we kind of retooled everything and said, we're going to call ourselves Tales of the Talisman. Laura Givens came on board as art director. We got, she knew a number of great artists. For a brief time, actually, as we got started, Nick Johns actually was our founding art director, and he was there pretty much for the first issue and then had other callings and went off and pursued other things, and then Laura's been with us ever since. Between the two of them, though, they brought in a bunch of great artists, really gave us a good visual look, and we've been Tales of the Talisman ever since, and we're now 7 years as Tales of the Talisman, so, you know, 17 years doing this. What's been great is, you know, it's the process of discovering people who've gone on to do really wonderful things. We've had authors like Neil Asher, who's had several successful books with Tor. We have, you know, we've had C.J. Henderson, who this weekend, in fact, coming up is guest, one of the guests of honor at Mile High Con, and has some novels coming out. And you know, we have Richard Harland, who's had some good steampunk books come out with Simon and Schuster. You know, it's been wonderful to see some of these people who, you know, maybe little earlier in their career kind of got their start with Tales of the Talisman, with Hadrosaur Tales, have gone on to get some mainstream success. And, you know, I kind of keep, every time I buy a new story, I kind of wonder, you know, is this going to be the next next Neil Asher or Richard Harland?
Yeah. Well, you know, and right, and you've had Rick Novi, and you know, I mean, Rick, you know, right? Rick Novi was in he's been in a couple of Tales
Rick Novi, yeah, Rick Novi's been in two or three times. David Boop, of course, you've been in the magazine.
Yes.
And Jenny Lee Simner's been in. You know, and we've had art from people like Liz Danforth. And, you know, it's really been a great ride, and I've gotten to know a lot of really good people through this. And, you know, it's gotten to the point, you know, I've had, you know, there are times when I've grabbed some stories that needed a fair bit of editing, but, you know, in some ways, as far as editing is concerned, it's gotten to the point where I've been able to become quite selective in the magazine, and I almost don't, you know, it almost feels kind of sinful in a way to call myself an editor, because I, you know, I buy such good and polished stories these days that I almost feel like I don't edit much anymore. I kind of pick the stuff I like and print it as I get it.
You ready?
Wishy.
Jack Mangan.
Gummaget.
Deadpan.
Deadpan.
Podcast?
Okay.
Well, although, you know, from the days where I was more active in the short story game, I know that seems to kind of be the tone of that field right now. It seems to be, you know, get us stuff that, you know, that's good, that can stand pretty much on its own. It might need a change or two, but I mean, that seems to be the tone in other markets. But you know, it is actually an excellent publication. It, you know, it looks fantastic. You know, you do always get, you know, the artwork is always really arresting, and it's always, and you know, and as you said, you got just great names, you know, coming through there. And I think, you know, I'll just say, I think, you know, the science fiction world definitely needs Tales of the Talisman. So I'd say that, you know, If you do ever start to feel like you're burning out, then I don't know, you need to find some way to keep it going, because I think the science fiction world needs what you do.
Well, thank you. It's I hope we can keep going with this for some time to come, because it's been a lot of fun. Who knows? It might, over the years, we've changed from Hadrosaur Tales to Tales of the Talisman. Every now and again, I toy with, maybe we might change to a slightly different format. But, I hope in some way or another to keep bringing out short fiction by new and emerging people, as well as established names that will submit to us.
And, well, very cool. Yeah, and I guess, and that website is, you can Google. The website is google.com. It is very easily findable. And of course, I actually first found it before I ever had any inkling that I'd run into you at Leprechaun or CopperCon. I found it through raylan.com.
Yeah, and we're just talesofthetalisman.com. I'll run together as one word.
All right. And I do want to just throw that out there too, that, this guy, as busy as David is, I the first time I met him, I don't want to say anything negative at all about our local cons, because they're really great and they're run by great people. But they used to be like kind of more rockin', I guess, back, about half a decade ago. And that's, I remember kind of doing the con party run with you and Nicole Gibbons-Kurtz and with some other locals. I don't even remember who else we had with us. I think some of the Dragon Page folks. But I remember that was how, we got to hang out, really, kind of going from party to party at those cons. And that was... those are some good memories. That was a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, and there's still some good parties at the cons, and that's one of the things we've gotten to be a tradition at TusCon is every year Marty Masolia and I have a party to celebrate our anniversary year at TusCon. So another inducement to come down to Tucson.
Most excellent. So. I do want to, I do want to leave off. I want to wrap things up actually probably one of your most amazing triumphs. I know you and your family have overcome something. You have another great story in you, and I'll let you really set the stage and tell as much as you want to about it. But I know that you have a great personal victory in your family's life here.
Well, and really, it the credit all goes to my wife on this. It's this is the story of just about a year and a half ago. We learned that she had breast cancer, and when it first came up, we learned that there was something to investigate. They did the lumpectomy, and we thought, okay, she had history in the family of there being benign lumps. We figured, okay, it's no big deal. She's going to go in, get tested. It's not going to be anything worse than that. And, I had the phone call that every husband dreads, and that is that indeed it turned out to be cancer. But fortunately, it sounds like the plug for Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but they're absolutely right. Go in for the regular screenings, because they caught it early with her. We went through, she did surgery, had the cancer removed. They tested lymph nodes, and all came out clean. She followed that up with chemotherapy. It ends up being, a challenging kind of year, because you have all of this stuff going on. And I have to say a big thank you to friends, both neighbors here in Las Cruces who came in and pitched in. And while I was at the observatory working, they would come and check on Kumi. I would, the kids stepped up in really amazing ways. They grew up a lot last summer. I couldn't have asked for them to have been better sports than they were, throwing in, helping with dinner, when I couldn't be here, helping me when I was here. Really, really all the credit goes to, the big credit here goes to Kumi for having to have lived through that, for being brave through the whole experience of breast cancer. And I think, you know, as she said, her real worry in the thing was she wasn't really afraid of what would happen to her, but she was afraid of what might get left undone, and that everything would have been done. And that just speaks to her that she was more worried about the rest of us than she was for herself. So what I really want to, you know, it just comes down to, I think that, you know, the key message here is, you know, people need to go out, get the regular screenings, be tested for this. It's an ultimately defeatable disease. It looks like, you know, we're now at the point a year and a half later that Kumi doesn't have to go into the doctor except once every 6 months. So as far as everyone is concerned, that's about as close to completely defeated as you possibly can be. It's a happy ending to a really difficult time. And, you know, I think as long as everyone pulls together, you can beat this thing.
Yeah, and that's you know, that's an amazing story. And, you know, and thank you. I know I talked to David before we started recording, and, you know, thank you very much for sharing that with us. And it's just, again, you know, I remember meeting her, and you know, I just give her a big hug, because that's such an amazing thing. And congratulations to you guys. It's a horrible beginning of the story, but it's wonderful, you know, how you guys, it's a wonderful victory. And, you know, I kind of got chills while you're telling the story. So, again, thank you for sharing.
Oh, you're welcome. And the scary part is, after I started hearing about, you know, once we started going through this, then I suddenly sort of became very aware of all of these stories of, you know, just as recently as 10 years ago, women dying in their 40s, you know, same age as Kumi and I are. And, you know, gee, just 10 years ago, you know, all kinds of, we lost all kinds of women to this. And it just amazes me that we've come so far. You know, it's a science fiction story of our own lifetime in a way. And I think that's just absolutely fantastic.
That's true. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's also science fact. I mean, it's all the more reason why, you know, science is, you know, so, so damn important, you know, in everything we do. You know, without science research and without the research and funding for the research, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, these miracles. So that's, you know, that's a great thing. And so David, I want to say thank you very much. And I will encourage everyone to go out and hit your website and try and catch you in your appearances. I know. And congratulations again, being fan guest of honor at TuscCon. And, if there are any other personal appearances that you know of in 2012 or 2013, then let's pimp those, and then I'll let you go to bed, because I know I've kept you up kind of late here to talk to us.
Well, you know, that sounds kind of funny for a guy who spends all night at a telescope. But after TuscCon, I think the next big one coming up is Her Royal Majesty's Steampunk Symposium. I'll be one of the guests there with Sherry Priest and O.M. Gray. That's on the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California in January. And you can find out about that at hrmsteam.com. And then after that, we're starting to kind of get things lined up for the rest of 2013. But that's the next big one after TuscCon.
All right. Well, great. And hopefully, you know, we'll cross paths at one of the local AZ cons. And it's great talking to you. Thank you very much, David Lee Summers.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
Okay. I'm going to do my snappy thing. Thank you.